Welcome back to Old School Guns, the podcast that has the news, opinion, and answers to the questions that you have asked. So it's great to have you back again. Of course, to give you our usual disclaimer, we are sponsored by no one. The cheapskates have not yet seen fit to sponsor us, and we actually don't even solicit it, so it's not a big deal. So anytime you hear me mention a product, it's not because I'm hawking it because I'm getting something in return. It's because I actually believe in it. Or if I'm criticizing one, it's not because I'm pushing a competitor. It's because I don't believe in it. Same thing for we are not yet on any kind of a affiliate or any kind of a podcast network. And that's just fine with me. I've actually submitted it to a couple. We'll see if they show any interest. So far, they have not. So, you know, just as far as you're concerned, this is great, unconnected and unabridged comment that you are the beneficiary of. So let me address a couple things. In the last podcast, there were a couple of gaps, like I think about 10, 15 seconds. There were two gaps. Sorry about that. I think that was because we're in the middle of a heat wave here in the Midwest, and I think my machine and a few things were overheating. So you didn't miss any content, and I decided to leave them in there. I couldn't really get an efficient way to edit that out, so I'm just going to leave it stand. But just understand we're aware of it, and thank you for putting up with it. But it didn't really affect anything, so... So that was the glitch that we discovered last time. Didn't even find out about it until I'd actually put it up. It didn't show on the software or anything we used until I went ahead and published the episode and then listened to it just kind of as a final check. And that's when I decided I'd leave it there because there was no gap showing in the software. There's no real way I can edit it. So, and recording it all over again loses all that great originality. So there you are. Hey, our first news story is the Gang of Four. We talked about them yesterday. The Ocasio-Cortez, who looks like she's just discovered a UFO. Tlaib, who always looks angry. Omar, who looks confused. And Presley, who I don't even know. I wouldn't even know her if I tripped over her. Never looked at a picture of her. They've accused Nancy Pelosi of being a racist for making them work and isolating them and picking on them. And, you know, it's about time the Democrats got a little taste of their own medicine. Maybe now some of those fools will understand that you can't have a country, you can't have a governing body, you can't have anything if everybody's going to run around and call each other racist when they get mad. You know, the race card is way overplayed in this country. Racism is way overplayed. And I think people are starting to get sick and tired of it. You know, they may see a backlash in 2020. God, I hope so. Frankly, we need to win back all those swing districts that were lost in 2018 and get some adults back in charge. Even imperfect adults are better than the children we see now. You're just seeing childlike behavior, and it's disgusting. It really is. Running around and calling people racist. I don't like Nancy Pelosi. I think she's a fool. I think she's probably not very intelligent, and I think a lot of things about her that are not very kind. But I don't believe for a minute she's a racist. I just don't. I just don't. I've never seen any racist behavior from Nancy Pelosi, so I don't believe she's a racist. Now that doesn't stop her from being an idiot and everything else. And being a conniving, you know, backstabbing politician, crooked politician. That doesn't stop her from being any of those things. But it does stop her from being a racist. There's just no racist behavior there. And, you know, frankly, anybody who even utters a word that can be construed as racist is basically hauled up on their own petard and publicly abused browbeaten, so that, you know, I don't really think we have any you know, overt racists in government. I mean, I just don't think we do. You know, there was a guy in Iowa who had said some silly things and all that, but no, you know, nobody really nobody really pays attention. I think if you want to look for a racist in government, I think you should look at the governor of Virginia, who apparently, you know, in college he got the nickname Coon Man, which is very offensive to black people. That was designed to be offensive. He ran around in blackface, and there's a picture of him in the yearbook. So evidently I would assume he did it more than once. That plus the nickname. And the other thing is, then he lied about it, and even the university said, no, there was no mistake. That was his picture. So, you know, look at him, and then he was talking about doing Michael Jackson stuff. I mean, that's all weird. That's all weird, and that's very, very race-based. So I would say he's probably the racist. I'm sure you could find some others, but, you know, that's just not a predominant thing. And racist has become the pejorative that people yell when they're angry or they're arguing with someone else. I've had a guy at work, you know, and he's of Puerto Rican descent, and you know, pretty nice guy and all that. He started going off one time about, well, you know, how did your grandfather speak about this? And of course, he knows nothing about my family, so he has no idea what he's talking about. But it was just this veiled thing of, well, you're a racist and don't know it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, this guy was a moron, a grade A moron, and he was making a moronic point that doesn't lead anywhere. Doesn't matter what anybody said. It matters about how you conduct yourself. So I just think that calling Pelosi a racist shows you how low, how stupid, how out of touch this Gang of Four really is. And I just think it's funny. Democrats now get to figure out how to keep these kind of people in line. And it isn't funny anymore to them, I'm sure. And I'm sure they're having meeting after meeting of how to get these little brats under control. And, you know, identity politics always kind of winds up here. It always winds up where you got these uncontrollable people who are, you know, just representing a certain small faction of society or some sort of identity group. And, you know, and that's what they do. That's their first and foremost thing. They're not doing anything constructive. It's not like, oh, yeah, this is a good representative. And oh, by the way, the person's this, that, or the other thing. No, it's who they are up front. Same thing with these losers, this soccer team, you know, the international women's soccer team or whatever. You know, most of them look like they're nice people, and they should enjoy their day in the sun. Man, they're a good soccer team. They're a really good soccer team, and we produce really good female athletics in the United States because we have Title IX, which says, hey, if you got a male program, you got to have kind of a corresponding female program. So there's a lot of opportunity there, and you can develop some really good players. And, you know, even if you're not a super patriot or you have some sort of axe to grind, and I'm talking about this Rapinoe person, you know, if she had just stood up for the national anthem or sung along or whatever she was supposed to do, just act that way. And, you know, You can then have a forum and express your views some other way. But the disrespect for the country, the effing White House comment and all that, she's made a fool out of herself. And when her 15 minutes of fame are over, she's going to be long forgotten. I mean, if she thinks she's going to be like Kaepernick and get some money from these people, or Nike's going to show her their new sneakers to see if she approves, I think she's sadly mistaken. You know, the sad part is this is the zenith of her career. This is probably the highest point in her life, and she wrecked it. She wrecked it for herself, and she wrecked it for a lot of people who normally would have wished her very, very well and would have said, well, you know, she's a great soccer player and all that, and not even really took any kind of a stance or anything on what her sexuality is. What the sports idiots and celebrity culture and pop culture, whatever you want to call that, whatever those morons better start figuring out everybody's tired about having this drummed into them and having it pushed at them. And we may see a difference. You know, right now we're in a sports inundated culture where, you know, you have basketball finals and now we have World Cup soccer and baseball and all these professional sports are overlapping to the point where there's always several of them going on at one time or ramping up. You know, football will be ramping up here very shortly. So it's we live in a culture that's going to have a lot of choices where people can spend their time, and they may choose to do it in the non-politicized ones. So that's what I think on those lines. And maybe people will actually get off their couches and go do something active and participate in sports that way. Okay, the VA special session. That was a bust. Yeah, that bum, the guy we were talking about earlier, the governor of Virginia, a bum, tried to the big deflection play and figures everybody will forget about his little misdeeds if he can do something on gun control. It blew up in his face. But part of the really good reason it blew up in his face was people got off their duffs, went down, made themselves heard. They obviously made themselves heard to their representatives. And they did a really good job. They did a very, very good job. And you know, the NRA, everybody's been cracking on the NRA. I've said some things about the NRA that, you know, they need to improve on. But, you know, the NRA is still a formidable organization. The people who say, oh, it's in real trouble, they're full of baloney, man. They're full of baloney. The NRA is an extremely formidable organization and a very powerful force when it talks about mobilizing people. And that's the way it should be. It's protecting a very fundamental right, a right that people want to just legislate out of the Constitution with a bunch of little nitpicky laws. And it started in 1934. It never should have gone. That never should have gone in place, the NFA, and it never should have stayed in place. Absolutely an abridgment of Second Amendment rights. And of course, the second vice president was out on Facebook. Willis Lee was out there, you know, championing this and campaigning. And a lot of people, I'm sure, got the word through his dissemination of when and where it was going to be and all that good stuff. So he's actually to be commended. He's above this fray. If you don't like the whole business of the business suits and Ackerman McQueen and NRA TV and all the rest of that, you can at least take solace that there's a functioning, effective part of the organization. And the second vice president, I don't know anything about the first vice president. I don't see him doing much. But the second vice president is out there battling the anti-Second Amendment foes. And that's what we need. That's exactly what we need. Related to that, the NRA is launching a new community engagement division. And, you know, I think obviously these last annual meetings have served as a wake-up call. I mean, I think that this is an attempt to get back in touch with some of the grassroots organizations, members, and you know, people down in the neighborhood, if you will. You know, that's where the power of the NRA has always been. It's not that, you know, we have enough members and voters to sway a national election. What we do is rate candidates, and that starts at the local level and goes all the way up to the national level. So, you know, the NRA is a powerful organization because it can fight against anti-Second Amendment tyranny on a whole lot of fronts and a whole lot of levels, from local ordinances up to national laws in the Congress. And they don't do it alone. They do it with their members, obviously, and also these partnered organizations, a lot of state organizations, a lot of specific types of shooting organizations, and a lot of clubs. You know, a lot of clubs on the local level are NRA affiliated. And in my club, you have to be an NRA member to join. It's a private club. So they make the rules, and you have to be an NRA member to join. And I think that's a great thing. That's That's a very, very good thing. And I think this new community engagement division will, get down and definitely you'll see more of the NRA than just a magazine every month. And I think that's going to be a great thing. And as far as NRA TV is concerned, I don't know that it was ever that great. I mean, it seemed like there was a lot of space they had to fill. Some of the content was good, some of the content not so good. I think getting away from Ackerman McQueen is a very, very positive thing. We just can't be a Republican phalange organization. Or when the Democrats take charge, like they have in the House, and may take charge of something else in 2020, hopefully not, or in 2024, when that happens, you're going to get punished. They're going to go out and deliberately punish gun owners because they're going to see us as political foes. And one of the things they do is punish their political foes. They think all Republicans are rich, which is a fallacy, which is why they do all this tax the rich shit. And that's why they do all this tax the rich propaganda they put out. It's also why they raise taxes. They don't care about you in the middle class. They want to raise your taxes. And if they think that you're some middle class Republican, then they're going to punish you. They're going to take your guns and raise your taxes. You're going to get up and go to work every day, pay more in taxes, and they're going to give that money to people who just do not deserve it. That's what they're going to do. Whether it's in free health care or you're going to pay for your child's tuition and some illegal is going to walk in and get it free. That's what it is. Or there's going to be some fakey reparations program or like Kamala Harris's thing where based on somebody's skin color, they're going to walk in and be able to buy a home that you can't qualify for. Or they're going to get some kind of leg up in a home ownership scam that she's going to start. And that's going to be money out of your pocket that's doing it. They're going to use your own money against you. That's what they do. That's who they are and what they do. And so if we don't become a more inclusive organization and bring in people who believe in gun rights, and gun rights are the thing that should unite gun owners, we don't really care about the rest. It's gun rights. And if we have gun rights and we have a strong position, and maybe people will mess with the Second Amendment less because they fear that part of their own constituency may get very upset with them and defect. Coming across and having a couple of discussions with people. People who are in and around law enforcement, people who are in and around all kinds of things. Apparently, and part of it is the advances in trauma medicine and a few other things. But if you're shot with a handgun, you have about a 90% chance of surviving it. That's just the way it is. And if you're in a big city, that's probably even a little bit higher because an ambulance can get to you quickly, paramedics can stabilize you, and the patient then goes to a hospital where they have surgeons who are used to seeing and trauma doctors and all this and all the equipment, and they're used to seeing gunshot wounds. So a person can survive that. And apparently in the twisted world of the inner city, in some sort of street thug way to get street cred, if you've been shot a bunch of times, that's looked upon as a heroic thing. If you've been shot and survived, that's a very heroic thing. I would not want that to happen to me, obviously, but then again, I'm sane. But some of these people aren't very sane. And one of the things I think that is come out of this is that crooks are not really afraid of handguns. Now, that goes against everything we're kind of trained on and everything we see on television. And a lot of what people think happens in real life, they get from television. So, it's in every movie. It's in every TV show. There's the bad guys. There's the good guy. The good guy pulls out a gun and the bad guy somehow a lot of times they shrink away, or the good guy is, you know, intimidates them and goes away. And in fact, it used to be one of the big things. They said, well, you know, just the mere presence of a firearm can deter all this. Well, apparently that deterrence is less than what it used to be, because people, these thugs aren't afraid of handguns. And the survivability rate is probably attributable to a lot of different things. One is, most of the guns you run across in those kind of circumstances, you know, thug on thug or whatever, are a lot of low-end guns. So they don't necessarily work very well, and they're not necessarily very powerful, and, you know, it's shooting some kind of ball ammunition that's probably not very good. So, or a mixture of ammunition, or maybe they get three shots off, and, you know, it goes on and on why these weaker, inferior guns, maybe a guy only gets shot twice, and as opposed to having a whole magazine emptied into him because the gun malfunctions. So there's a whole list of reasons why this probably is, but it's very ominous. If you get jumped by somebody or accosted, you pull a gun, the immediate thought is, hey, they're going to back off. They're going to give some sort of pause. And the truth is there's a very high probability that they will not. So you better be prepared and act accordingly. Maybe you have to draw that thing and just start firing, which, you know, if you draw it, I've never been a fan of brandishing a gun. I think if you draw a gun, you had best be steeled to use it. And the only thing that should prevent you is if at the mere sight before you shoot that first round, somebody starts cowering and running away. I realize this is all simplistic, and there's different situations and all kinds of different things. The thing to take away from it, though, is that a lot of the people you run into are not going to be afraid of a handgun. Rifles, probably a different matter. You see those more out in rural areas, and people, even if they're not the best people, but they grew up out there, they kind of know that a rifle inflicts a lot more damage, and if it can bring down a game animal twice the size you are, it's probably not going to it's not going to be something you can just slough off. So they take that more seriously. It's actually I think, from what I understand, that some of these crooks are more afraid of the tasers than they are of the sidearms, because getting a dose of the lightning is infinitely more unpleasant. It doesn't have the street cred, and I guess that's a much worse experience, although I can't imagine a worse experience than being shot. I just can't. But in their twisted world, where they have a hierarchy of all this, believe it or not, tasers are probably more feared than a sidearm. And the other thing is, they know the rules of engagement. They know when a police officer can shoot at them. They basically know when an armed citizen can shoot at them. And so, you know, they play all those rules to their advantage. So don't think that your CCW handgun is a secret talisman. It's not a lucky rabbit's foot. It's not a magic wand that's going to get you out of trouble. It's just another tool. And the best weapon is the one you carry between your ears, which is staying away and out of trouble. And that way you don't have to rely on those things. We talked about In the Gravest Extreme, and that's something that you should definitely read that book and get at least the aspect of it, of what happens after you shoot. But you also I would have people study how to avoid, you know, just use your spidey sense and don't go to places where there's a high risk of running into trouble. Okay, we're going to start my favorite part of the show, which is Q&A. And all right, the first question is, name four companies related to firearms that you like. Okay, that's probably pretty easy. So I'll start. The first one I'll say is Brownells. I've had nothing but very positive customer service interactions with Brownells. I've got nothing but first-rate products from them. I think that their retro rifles are first-rate. They're at least as good as what Colt put out, and I would say that you could probably they will measure up against any other similar type of gun anywhere. You could take the highest end AR-15, and I bet if you ran rounds through it, I don't think the Brownells guns would. I don't think they're going to get outperformed by any significant degree, if they're even outperformed at all. So I think Brownells is really a first-rate company, and plus they have the parts. They also have expertise. They'll help you with stuff. They're really a first-rate company, and I think they're probably, you know, the model that everybody else should get. And there are other great companies out there too, but the one that just leaps to the forefront for me is Brownells. Another one is Fort Scott Munitions. I think they're innovators. They're guys who really want to put out some great product there. They don't really make like inexpensive blasting ammo. They really don't do that. What they do is put out, you know, really good quality stuff. And, you know, if you want blasting ammo, how do you compete with Tula, or Tull ammo? However they pronounce that. How do you compete with, you know, some of the steel cased craptastic stuff for a lot of uses? And the answer is you don't. So you have to have quality. And there's also, this kind of goes back to this thing about why aren't thugs afraid of handguns? Well, you know, there's a lot of low powered ammunition out there, cheap ammunition and cheap ball ammunition. It might function the gun just fine, but most guns will function within a wide band of pressure and performance. So the stuff that's on the low end, it may be functioning the gun just fine, or it may not. It may only get off one or two shots, or you might have to hand cycle it. But you know, weak, low-powered ammunition is probably one of the reasons that they're not afraid of handguns like they were. But Fort Scott puts out some first-rate stuff and really some great designs. So, you know, when you want premium ammunition, I think I've had nothing but good interactions with them. And there are other great companies out there, too. So, but they're the one that kind of just leaps to mind, is if I list four dissimilar companies that kind of provide to the shooting community, I'd definitely grab them. Another one is not very well known. It's a company, and you have to look it up on the internet, called Redheaded T-Shirts. And Redheaded T-Shirts make some of the coolest T-shirts, you know, vintage, historical, just great stuff. They make just great stuff. And a lot of fun, a lot of M1, World War II, you know, Allied Axis kind of stuff. A lot of it's a lot of fun stuff, and a lot of caps that, you know, say International Harvester, M1 Garand, and, you know, these things that you really can't get, but they're kind of cool. Definitely cool range clothing, and even good for some other uses. I've given a lot of the stuff as gifts. It's reasonably priced, so it's not the $40 t-shirt that you see other places. It's really good stuff, a lot of fun, and, you know, quality product. I've had some laying around. They have never given me anything, and I'm not, you know, this is not in a quid pro quo. This is just, I like their stuff. They're not a very well-known company, and I think they'd be a lot of fun to, your friends will be amazed if you kind of give these out as gifts or whatever. And the last one is a surplus company that I ran across a couple years ago, and they're actually located in Finland, and it's Varusteleika. And they are, you know, a Finnish company. They're funny. They absolutely have a great sense of humor. They get some interesting stuff in, stuff you really don't see. Some of it you see from over here. You know, some of it is kind of the standard fare that you would see. The other stuff, pretty darn good. A lot of European stuff. They're canvassing, you know, Eastern and Western Europe and probably some other places, and they get some interesting stuff in there. I really enjoy it. They're funny. They even have some food products that are pretty funny, and you know, it's a lot of fun. And they ship to the United States for about $10 flat rate. So it's like getting from somebody else. But it might take you a week or so to get the stuff, because it does come, you know, I don't think it comes on a boat anymore. But it probably comes on an airplane and has got to pass through customs. So It's pretty good, and they have stuff that you won't find anywhere else. And they've got a few shooting things, mostly like clothing and things like that. You know, the European laws, and Finland is part of the EU. You know, they have some very stringent firearm weapons of war, blah, blah, blah. All that pablum that the liberals put out to try to control the surplus market of what sportsmen can have and can't have. So they have to abide by all that. But you know, they get combat shirts and bits and pieces of uniforms and bits and pieces of kit that are very interesting and cool. So Varusteleika, they have also partnered with InRange TV to sponsor the Desert Brutality. And I think they have a companion match in Finland called Finnish Brutality. But if you want to see more of Varusteleika, go to InRange TV. They have those guys on there, and they've interviewed them over the last couple of years intermittently and gotten some stuff. And they've done a really good job with it. I think InRange has kind of helped kind of, you know, show them to the American audience. And it's a very interesting perspective and an interesting company, that's for sure. Okay. What is my impression of steel-cased Russian ammo, specifically Tull ammo? I always called it Tula. I mean, I always saw the TULA and then the MMO I didn't pay much attention to. So I always called it Tula after the arsenal ammo, but I think it's actually Tull ammo. How, or is it Tula Mo? I don't know. I don't know what it's called. You know, I think it's good ammunition for your AK. I mean, the AK was. I don't know that it's proper to say the AK was designed for steel case ammo. I don't know if that's a correct statement. But obviously, they were going to use it. Obviously, that's the kind they tested with it. And so, I think it is correct to say the AK was optimized for use with steel cased ammo. And it's great for that. I mean, it's, you know, it just. The AK eats it up, and there it goes. It's great ammunition for that. I think their 9mm is okay. I don't care for their 45. The 9mm is fine. I'll stick with that first. 9mm is fine. It's not plus P. It seems a little underpowered to me, but that's strictly subjective. Could very well be that it's fine, but. Seems a little underpowered, but it's fun to shoot. And when you're practicing, it's perfectly fine for that. If you are a person that needs to store ammunition for any period of time for prepping or for whatever kind of use, you know, you live out in the boonies and say, "Hey, I'm going to buy some ammo, and this I'm just going to kind of sit on it until I use it all up." It does store well. It's good ammo. You can buy it. It's very attractively priced, so I wouldn't have any problems using it. A lot of the you know, kind of pistol caliber carbines, I think, can use it reasonably well. I'm going to try some in my Suomi. I haven't really shot that very much, and it's kind of a very cool gun. And when I say use it, you know, I'm not recommending that this is what you go out and fight World War III with. Although, you know, it is ammunition and it does work. It's strictly ball ammunition and it performs in a ball ammunition manner. So, you know, your mileage may vary, but it's great practice ammo, great shooting ammo, and face it, that's most of the shooting we do. The stuff I don't care for. I've seen and used some of the 5.56, and actually it worked just fine. I'm not a real fan of it. I don't know why. Maybe it's just my own preferences. But I like brass cased rifle ammo. I would not use it in an M1 rifle or a semi-automatic 7.62 NATO rifle. That's just, I think, common sense. The M14 and the FN were really designed around NATO spec, and really optimized to use NATO spec 7.62 by 51 ammo. A G3, I have fired some in a G3, and it's worked out fine. So I can't really complain about it there. And you know, it's the only ammo that I can really get that I trust to use in a PSL because. It is light ball. The set there 7.62 by 54R comes in 148 grain loading, which is light ball. Because if you use any heavier bullets in, I think a SVT or a PSL, you're going to run into some problems, and those problems are going to be the, you know, the accelerated wear and some of the other stuff on there. So in those rifles, they recommend light ball and the tall ammo, Tula ammo, whatever it is, Tulamo, whatever that is, seems to fill the bill just fine. And the nice part about it is it's, of course, new ammo and it's non-corrosive primed. Some of the light ball surplus you get, you know, who knows? You have to just treat that as corrosively primed, which means a very, very detailed cleaning and also observation after the cleaning to make sure that that corrosion doesn't get in there. So overall, I like the ammo. I think steel-cased ammo is fine for most of what we do. Nice part about it is, I have to tell you selfishly, hey, I don't have to pick up empties, you know, I can just kind of gather them up and throw them away, or I don't have to worry about finding all my empties. You know, there's, when it comes to some of the harder to find calibers, like 351 Winchester comes to mind, you know, you lose two or three of those in the grass and it's a big deal. So with this, you don't lose any in the grass. You if you do, it's not a big deal, and you're going to throw them away anyway, sweep them up and throw them away anyway. So Tula ammo, basically a good deal. Haven't really shot, you know, there's all this other stuff out there, Brown Bear, Silver Bear, Red Army Standard. Haven't used those enough to really know. I would assume that these things kind of come off, if not the same factory, kind of similar factories. So again, your mileage may vary. There have been a few reports from some of this Russian ammo that, you know, the blows out a case head or whatever else, mostly in the rifle stuff. I don't think the pistol stuff is much of a problem. So I would be, you know, a little bit careful. I would not use it in a premium rifle. I just wouldn't. You know, if you got an expensive rifle, use decent ammo. Their 45, I really don't care for that much. It reminds me a lot of something that no one has seen for a long time, which is the old USGI steel case stuff. I know that they say don't use it in a Thompson, so of course I had to try it. And the funny part was I chambered around and I fired a couple rounds and they fired. Then I took the magazine out and I cleared the chamber and an empty came out with powder all over it. I'm like, what's going on here? I should have been a loaded round in the chamber. And there was. The ogive of that bullet, it had fit into this, you know, the semi-automatic Thompson. It fit into it and it gripped the rifling enough so that when I went ahead and pulled the bolt back, the bullet stayed and the cartridge case pulled out and it spilled powder. The powder that was inside it pulled out all over the place. And so, you know, that's another concern I have with it also, is be careful in semi-automatic, the 45 especially, that in a semi-automatic pistol caliber carbine or even a pistol, that you don't set the bullets back or they don't pull out like that, because that'll, you know, that's where you get the cleaning rod and you have to tap the bullet out. It's no big deal, taps right out, just one or two taps and it's back out. But on a range, that's going to foul you up, or in competition that would pretty much ruin your ruin the string of shooting you're doing. And I don't know if that's because steel, and I don't know if it's because the brass adheres better to the copper jacketed bullet, or if there's a dynamic, there's some sort of friction dynamic in there, or if it's just, that's just the way it is. You know, it just isn't made, the bullet might have been undersized, maybe the case was a little bit oversized, who knows. But I tend to believe that it probably doesn't hold the bullet in there with the same friction that a brass case would. So I would be pretty careful of it, especially in something like a Thompson where you got a big heavy bolt banging back and forth when you fire it. It's awful easy for the bullet to slam up against the feed ramp and either get pushed back in, or when you extract it, like happened to me, it just pulls right out. So that's my information on that. And again, I'd never use it in an M1, and never, you can use it in your your bolt action, I suppose. I don't know that there's any real cost benefit or any real great benefit to doing that. But, you know, I would not use it in like USGI or NATO spec rifles, G3 being an exception, but G3 will gobble up anything. You know, G3 is interesting. It was basically designed with a lot of the experience the Germans had on the Eastern Front. So the AK and the G3 kind of share some, they're different approaches that solve the same problems. And one of them is, in a total war where you're fighting the hordes, whether it's Russians fighting the German hordes or Germans fighting the Russian hordes, you might not have the greatest ammo in the world. Quality might suffer. So if you have a gun that can handle some of the lower end stuff, that's probably a big advantage. So I'm sure that's why they designed it the way they did. And the HK delayed roller is really pretty ingenious. My only complaint about it is, holy cow, is it dirty to clean. They talk about the M16 being dirty to clean. The M16 is pristine compared to the automotive grunginess that you can get in a G3, especially when you're shooting this kind of ammo. And I know that. So anyway, that's my take on that ammo. All right. Handgun scene internationally. I should have written this down more completely. The question that was asked to me of what handguns do you normally see internationally? When you travel, you know, in the United States, we've got handguns from everywhere, and we produce scads of our own. We import them, and everybody who can make handguns, and as long as they're not subject to some sort of sanctions or import ban, they export to the United States. So we see all kinds of stuff. You go to other countries, what do you see? And I'm no great international traveler. So what I will tell you is I usually try to look at, without looking too suspicious, I usually try to see what kind of firearms people are carrying. And it used to be pretty easy. In the Balkans, they were carrying Yugoslav M57s. And if you served in the Balkans, you know, you can go to, I think it's Classic Arms sells those. They're still getting a few importations of these things. And they're cheap. They're about $200, and it's a great souvenir. I bought one. Came with a holster and a cleaning rod and a spare magazine. Great gun to have. Absolutely great gun to have. So a great memento of your service if you served in the Bosnia, Kosovo, or even Macedonia region. So you used to see some of that. I think now you see a lot more German influenced. You'll see a lot more Glock. They're Austrian, but you'll also see H&K and a few things. Hey, countries can usually afford to buy pretty decent handguns for their armed forces. As far as the Soviet Union goes, I don't really know. I think it's kind of the same way. They can kind of buy what they want to use. Used to be it was all Makarovs. I think most of those are probably gone now from frontline service. Replaced with more efficient guns that don't have the heel release and some of these other kind of legacy design devices that we've seen in the past. A lot of places, though, I think you'll see the CZ-75 is alive and well in a lot of places. You know, the Czechs are very, very shrewd. They sell a lot of guns to smaller emerging countries, so you'll see a lot of that. And the Belgians sold scads of high powers, Browning high powers, or Browning P-35s, whatever you want to call them, but they've sold untold scads of those for decades and decades and decades, starting right after World War II and going up into the early 2000s. You will see them everywhere, and they last. They last really well. I remember seeing Canadians in Iraq with the Inglis high power, which a World War II gun, they last. And they were built under license in a lot of places, South America, Argentina, and a few other places. So, if you go off, you're going to probably see really good chance of seeing a Browning high power in a holster. It's just, CZ75 Browning High Powers, I would say you have a good chance of seeing those. You also have a very good chance of seeing any of the polymer pistols from Germany and Austria. You know, that's just, and you know, 9mm is basically ruling, as we spoke about last podcast, it's ruling the world. I don't know that any armed force, the Russians are always, they're always at the beat of their own drum, but you know, almost everybody has standardized on 9mm. That's just the way it is. So you'll find that'll be the ammo you find. You won't really find 45 ACP or any of this other stuff out there. So that's what you're going to see internationally. And again, my experience is pretty limited, but I always try to do that. One of the coolest things I did when I first was getting very interested in guns, we were doing a exercise called Return of Forces to Germany, called Reforger, and we had to land at Schiphol Airport in Netherlands. And this was the first place I'd ever landed that was outside of the United States. I mean, I'd never left the United States before. And so we're in these tents, and it's winter time. They always did these things in January. So you could, because if they did them in January, they ensured you dreaded them over Christmas. And, you know, we're not looking forward to freezing all your bodily parts off. As it turned out, it was a great experience, but of course we were dreading it when it happened. So we're at Schiphol Airport, and not at where the commercial jets land, but there's, like a lot of European airports, there's a military side and a civilian side. So we're in the Netherlands, and they have these Dutch reservists who are guarding it, and I'll be darned, one of them was carrying an M1 rifle, and another one was carrying an M1 carbine. And this is in the, kind of mid-1980s. And there they are, you know, there they are. And I'm like, wow, you know, that's cool. And I had, I can't remember if I had my Garand by then. I probably did. I think I did have my Garand by then. So I had bought an M1 Garand, and to see someone in uniform carrying the rifle that I shot recreationally was really pretty trippy. And I think I actually had an M1 carbine at that time too, I think. No, I bought that later. But I knew what it was. I'd fired the carbines before. So that was a really, really cool thing to see, was those kind of weapons being used internationally, still kind of in the last throes of service there. Okay, the next question. What is the best Buffalo rifle caliber? I got to think about that. I shoot black powder cartridge kind of intermittently, mostly the military stuff. I don't really shoot the Buffalo rifles. But, and Buffalo, I mean American bison. I don't mean that other thing that's in Africa that hides and kills about a dozen people a year. I don't, what do they call it? Cape buffalo. No, it's not Cape buffalo. It's American bison, that kind of buffalo. The kind of meat you can buy at high-end stores. They got buffalo meat. I have to say that I know just enough about them. I load 5070, 577, 450, and 4570. I would have to say that if I were going to shoot buffalo, and I'm not, but if I were going to, I would use a 4570, and it's for all the chicken reasons that you can imagine. Biggest chicken reason is brass is easy to get, bullets are easy to get, dyes are easy, everything's easy to get, and there's a lot of published material out there on how to load the 4574. Not only Buffalo rifles, I think Mike Venturino, guy who shot a lot of single shot rifles in like the 90s, he wrote a book. And I think there's other books out there, you know, and basically 4570 is cool. Now, 4570 is not the most romantic of these calibers. You know, people talk about, you know, 5140 sharps, which has to be a cannon, that thing. Everybody, I've not talked to a lot of people, but I've talked to like one or two guys who've shot that thing. And they say it is actually a brutal cannon to shoot. And they go, your desire to own one, even just for the cool factor, evaporates pretty quickly after you shoot it, because there's no real downloading that. You kind of go the full Monty on that. It's the same thing with a 405 Winchester. Yeah, this is Teddy Roosevelt's lion gun. And these guys buy it as like that curved butt plate. It definitely opens their eyes and they go, holy cow, you know, this thing really is punishing. So, you know, 4570 is not punishing. It is still a fairly common and it's kind of unglamorous caliber, but it's going to be the easiest to load, the easiest to get, the easiest in many ways to, you know, even in some stores, you can go and buy trapdoor only loads with a lead bullet and all that, which you know, if you're on a hunt and somehow your ammunition supply gets lost, hey, you can buy a couple boxes of that, re-zero, and you're back in business. I don't know that, you know, if you're shooting 4590 or you're shooting 45110 or some of these more, you know, kind of different cartridges out there. And there's like 4075 and all these kind of different things out there. If you're shooting those, you're not going to be able to pick them up even in the quote cowboy or trapdoor loads, which is what you'd really want to use if you're using it in a quote buffalo gun. And by a buffalo gun, I mean a single, you know, one of those single shots, like a Sharps or a Rolling Block. And there's a few others, I think High Walls and a few other things. To me, the coolest gun for doing that would have been an 86 Winchester. And they make good reproductions of them out there. They cost, what, for about $1,500, you can get a really nice 86 Winchester. And there's another one. What is it called? Is it called a 4070 or a 4560? The one they put it in a Winchester 1876 replica. It looks like a very fun gun. But again, you're not going to find that in cowboy loads just on a shelf somewhere if your ammo supply dwindles or you go through a lot more than you think you're going to. So, yeah, okay, last question, and this will be a quick one. What is your thoughts on natural disaster and survival armament? And I would say that they've written books on all this. They've written books. But really what I say is the guns that you're most familiar with, if you're a gun person, you're already going to know what guns you're most familiar with, whether it's your AR, whether it's your AK, whether it's whatever it is. You know, if you have an M1 and a great big ammo can filled with the clips, maybe that's it. You shoot M1 all the time and in the vintage matches and all that good stuff. Hey, you know, that's as good a choice as any. So it's really what you're most used to, what you're comfortable with, and what you have ammunition for. That's going to be a good choice. Same thing, survival armament. And too broad a question, have to say, is it survival from people? Is it survival from predators? Is it survival from a combination of both? And is it just, you know, looters, foragers versus the mutant biker gang, which is coming to, you know, absolutely do a scorched earth policy, and you happen to be in their way. Whatever all of those fictitious or fantasy scenarios are, I refer you to popular culture or to books that are already written to try to figure all that out. The most cogent general advice I can give you is get a good semi-automatic military rifle, practice with it, and choose the caliber most suited for your terrain. If you have a lot of wide open long shots, you might want a 308. If you have, or 308, I should say 7.62x51. And if you are in shorter ranges and denser vegetation and things where you need a faster handling weapon that has less recoil than 5.56, and you know the market's filled with all kinds of those, or both types of rifles, and they can be had in options that would give you, you know, whatever you really needed. So that's what I would tell you. Maybe we'll do a whole podcast on that and go through some theoreticals. So I'll table that question and say maybe that'll be a whole podcast. And I've got a couple. I got one guy who I think would be a very interesting guest with something like that, because he's actually lived through it. When he's a native of Argentina, and he actually lived through it, so he's got some of the best advice, I think, going. So anyway, that's it for Old School Guns. If you like what you hear and want to hear more, please hit the follower button. Please hit the like button, and you'll get a notification when our next episode is posted. And remember, we are beholden to no one. No one has any strings over us. So what you're getting is the pure, unadulterated truth as we see it. So hope you enjoy it. And this is Old School Guns out.